The year was 1888. The day, I shall never forget it, August the 31st. There was no swirling pea soup fog reducing the gas lamps to yellow blurs hanging in a cold gray sea. On the contrary, it was a mild night following an exceptionally warm evening. It had been a splendid summer, and seemed set for a pleasant autumn. If anything, these conditions increased, rather than diminished, the horror of the events that followed. Certainly, they left me all the more unprepared, as if one could ever be prepared, for such vile and unnatural evil.
So begins the first video game to ever get a UK 18+ rating, akin to today's M rating in the US. 1987's Jack the Ripper for the ZX Spectrum. As far as I know, the game itself was entirely text-based and didn't actually have any audio, so I threw that together with a text-to-speech synthesizer and some royalty-free ominous 8-bit music. Every paragraph ends with the narrator saying, "What was I to do?" And then you type in what you want to do. You have to get the wording 100% correct for it to do anything. It was basically an electronic choose-your-own-adventure book. Considering that the game was entirely text-based, there wasn't a lot in it that really demanded an 18+ rating. It didn't have any strong language, and sure, it was about Jack the Ripper, but there was no on-screen violence because, again, it was entirely text-based. There were movies with a lot more taboo stuff that had a much lower rating. Everyone involved in rating Jack the Ripper admits that the 18+ rating was just an attempt to drum up controversy and use it as a marketing tool. Look at how transgressive and envelope-pushing this game is. Don't you want to play it? I bet you do. That's mostly how the gaming community remembers Jack the Ripper. Less well-remembered is how goddamn weird the game is. Surprisingly for a game about Jack the Ripper, the plot isn't really about uncovering Jack's identity. Instead, the resolution involves the narrator physically going into the soul of one of Jack's victims, ending up in a dreamscape random events plot that would make Joel G. proud, and eventually wielding the power of the victim's pure and innocent femininity to defeat Jack the Ripper. You know, as you do in M-rated video games.
The world was pink and gentle. Sunlight filtered gently from a pink sky, and everything was pervaded with a subtle scent of roses. Rivers flowed with sweet milk, and every living thing seemed young and unafraid, as if it were newborn into a world of unconditional love. I knew that I was somehow within the very soul of Lady Maybank, walking, as it were, amid the essence of her feminine soul, encompassed by the flowers of her purity.
Rivers of milk? Ew. But seriously, this game actually sounds really good. These days, I'm into all sorts of trippy internet ephemera that's more or less like this. Stuff that's simultaneously super nerdy and yet weirdly emotional. If I grew up in the 80s with no internet and most video games just collections of pulsing dots, I'm sure I would vibe with this game. I don't know if it ever had a small but devoted cult following in its heyday, but I would have started one. Who made it? And were there other games like it? The short answers to these questions are, we have absolutely no idea, and not really. The long answer is, I'm your host Tor Parsons, this is my co-host Jollibee the Durian, and welcome to Tor's Cabinet of Curiosities. So the developer of the 1987 Jack the Ripper game was listed as St. Bride's School, which, I don't know if you might have noticed, it's a rather unlikely name for a video game developer. Weirder still was the fact that it was headquartered in a rural Irish village called Burtonport. Sure, Ireland is the Silicon Valley of Europe now. There are video game developers based in Ireland now. But in 1987, Ireland was poorer than Slovenia. Chances are the average Irish village in 1987 didn't have a single computer, let alone a video game company producing unusual and interesting games. What other games did St. Bride's School have up their sleeve? Well, in 1986 they put out Bugsy, a tale of a 1920s mobster rabbit who rises through the ranks of the Chicago mob, all while speaking in a strange dialect that sounds like an Irish attempt at sounding like an American film noir gangster. The final boss is, naturally, Al Capone. The same year, they put out a game called The Very Big Cave Adventure, which was a pun-filled parody of Colossal Cave Adventure, a hugely influential text-adventure game created way back in 1977. So, if they were winking at Colossal Cave Adventure, that suggests the folks at St. Bride's had a fairly detailed knowledge of video game history and were pretty dialed into the emerging game design scene. 1985 saw The Snow Queen, based on the same Hans Christian Andersen story that Disney would later make Frozen out of, and a few other strange games were released across the 80s. But the first known game ever released by St. Bride's School was one simply called The Secret of St. Bride's, a mystery set at a boarding school where everyone seems to believe they're in the Victorian era. Okay, well, that explains the name of the company. They named themselves after the first game so that people would know their later games came from the same people. You know, so that people go, oh, those people, I like their stuff. No, definitely not. It's way more complicated than that. I want you to listen to the opening narration of The Secret of St. Bride's and really take it to heart.
Today you've a mystery to solve. Last night you arrived at St. Bride's. The mistresses and girls really believe they are in an old-style boarding school. You even wonder if you're not a bit mad to think you're from the 1980s. You want to find out what's going on while you still can. Your adventure starts here.
And so does ours. Because almost everything in the game, The Secret of St. Bride's, was true of the real-life St. Bride's School. It was, supposedly, an all-girls boarding school, in a grand old manor on a one-street seaside Irish village. People in Burtonport would see the faculty of St. Bride's going around town in bonnets, bustles, and sweeping Victorian dresses. They would speak in an antique literary form of English. They would clop down the street in clogs in the middle of the night. Townsfolk remember the same women at St. Bride's giving different names depending on who they were talking to. And they made video games. In one of the many surreal anecdotes about encounters with St. Bride's, an electrician recalls being called on to fix their Commodore 64 computer. It seemed to be the only electric thing in the whole house. The inside of the house was dark, with women going around holding candles out in front of them. Aside from the computer, the only other source of entertainment was a wind-up gramophone, a very early type of record player. A woman calling herself the headmistress, who some people remember being named Mariana, and others remember being named Bridget, told the electrician that apart from the computer, quote, "we live in the Dark Ages." And it seemed that, in general, this was how the ladies of St. Bride's wanted to be known, not as visionary game designers, but as people who rejected the modern world entirely. Two women from St. Bride's appeared on Ireland's version of The Late Late Show in 1988, in their crinolines and petticoats, this time calling themselves Victorian Romantics. Tell me if these people sound like cutting-edge video game programmers to you.
Now, Miss Tyrrell was born in London to a family of teachers, educated in English, this is Miss Tyrrell here at Oxford, and herself taught kindergarten for many years before chucking it all in order to move to Ireland to live what she considers a better way of life. She is the mistress of the house. And Miss Rayner is originally from New Zealand, worked for many years in Australia as a legal secretary, and she too then felt that she would be better suited in the past rather than in the hustle and bustle of the modern world. And her position in the household in Burtonport is that of housekeeper. Now, a lot of people, Miss Tyrrell, will wonder, what are you actually up to in Donegal? What is all this about?
Well, in our house in Burtonport, we live as Victorians. I am the mistress, Miss Rayner's the housekeeper. The other girl that you saw on the film is Sophia, and she's the maid. And there are also other people in the house who are my friends. And we think of ourselves as the family, although we're not related.
Yes. And what is the purpose of this experiment? Why are you living this way in these clothes?
Well, we live this way because we like it, because we have fun dressing in beautiful feminine clothes, because we enjoy listening to records on our wind-up gramophone and different ways that we have of entertaining ourselves. We don't concern ourselves with the present at all. We live in a little world inside our house. We like the beauty of the area we live in and that one drives through if one's going to Donegal Town or somewhere like that. It's a world apart, really.
Making video games wasn't the only side hustle St. Bride's School was involved in. More characteristically of them, they had a business making and selling Victorian clothes, stitched with old-fashioned, hand-cranked sewing machines, and they published an amateur literary magazine called The Romantic. But their biggest industry, or at least the one they advertised the most, was the school itself. Straight-faced ads ran in British and Irish newspapers throughout the 80s, touting St. Bride's School as a genuine boarding school, with a standard classical curriculum, the cardinal subjects being mathematics, elementary Latin, grammar, and literature. The day begins with the rising bell at 7:30. Our girls receive the healthy benefit of lively sea air and fresh open countryside, and in the matter of sunshine, so vital to the health of growing children, we are singularly well favored. Attending there cost £120 a week. Now, of course, the readers weren't supposed to take the ads totally seriously, especially since the ads also mentioned they had a modern gramophone, for which great care is taken to avoid overwinding. They were selling St. Bride's as an immersive experience, where British and Irish women, mostly in their 20s and 30s, could go and pretend to be Victorian schoolgirls in some 19th century novel. It was like Disney World's Star Wars Hotel, except cheaper and Victorian. And again, sounds like fun, at least for a little while. There are plenty of people who remember paying the £120 to go there, pretending to be a schoolgirl, and seeing nothing weirder about it than that. But why did they also make video games? They had an explanation. It didn't make a ton of sense, but it made enough sense. When the early gaming magazine Crash sought out St. Bride's and interviewed the headmistress, this time going by the name she's most often known as, Miss Martindale, she gave this story. For one thing, she said they weren't getting as many paying visitors as they hoped, so they had to look for other streams of income. At one point, a woman named Priscilla Langridge showed up for her immersive Victorian vacation carrying a huge Commodore 64 computer with her, and instead of being aghast at this intrusion of the modern world, the mistresses of St. Bride's School were captivated. Miss Martindale discovered that unlike TV, which she called mind-rotting, computer games call for, quote, concentration and commitment, and therefore, unlike all other modern technology, she thought they were fine. And so, these people, who had no electricity and shunned almost everything invented in the 20th century, began designing video games. Langridge became a long-term member of their community, and is credited as the head designer of all of St. Bride's games. Is that a weird story? Sure, but it ties up all the loose ends. According to some of the people who stayed at St. Bride's, the reason the women had different names depending on who they spoke to was because they were playing characters. They were semi-serious about living in Victorian times, but they did have other interests beyond that. They were running a fake Victorian boarding school, both for fun and profit, and when they couldn't make a profit doing that, they turned to other interesting things, like, for instance, making video games. Today, you've a mystery to solve, indeed. And we solved it. Right? Right? St. Bride's School occupied the same manor house in Burtonport, Ireland, for about 10 years. They had a shaky peace with the locals of Burtonport, who saw them as harmless eccentrics, until February 1990. When the headmistress, who was now going by Miss Partridge and may or may not have been the same person as Miss Martindale, was fined £100 and served 2 months in jail for caning a woman she referred to as her maid. At her trial, Miss Partridge defended herself by saying her maid knew what she was getting into and had signed a contract that specified corporal punishment was okay. Around then, ads for St. Brides began to turn up in other places, not just in mainstream newspapers like the Sunday Times, but in adult magazines. Here they offered a different service. For £75, both men and women could be, quote, disciplined. Was the real secret of St. Brides something way kinkier? The press really ate up this discovery. The chaste Victorian boarding school that women supposedly went to just to relive their innocent childhood dreams was actually something a lot more scandalous. And looking back at the details of the school, people began to wonder why they didn't see this before. They referred to women as maids. In a 1984 interview with Woman Spirit, a lesbian feminist magazine published in Oregon, one woman from St. Bride said that, quote, "Some maids like to tell others what to do, and some maids like to be told what to do." A photographer who was invited into St. Bride's to take photos of their video games alleges that in the house's dark maze of halls, he saw a padded rubber room, which he was quickly ushered past and never got mentioned again. When the women of St. Bride's left Burtonport in 1992 after their house was repossessed, they cast off all doubt about being a fetish outfit. The former owners, retaking the house, found whips, handcuffs, and BDSM magazines in the house, all of which St. Bride's had been selling by mail order under various other names. By then, Miss Partridge / Miss Martindale and co. had decamped to Oxford, where a curious Sunday Telegraph reporter paid to get punished, for research purposes only, I'm sure. In 1995, Miss Martindale / Miss Partridge released a book called The Female Disciplinary Manual and publicized it with a press tour in which she spoke about the necessity of corporal punishment. But clearly this wasn't the whole story either, because all the kinky stuff went alongside the neo-Victorian stuff. One doesn't explain the other, rather this just adds a whole separate third dimension to St. Bride's. Before, they were a neo-Victorian immersive experience destination that also made video games. Now, there are still all those things and are also kinky lesbian dominatrixes. Adding this bizarre new twist doesn't actually clear anything up. The video games may have deliberately stoked controversy to sell, but they definitely didn't have anything adult in them. As for St. Bride's as a place to go to the Victorian era on vacation, that wasn't connected either. St. Bride's school didn't practice corporal punishment on its paying students. The official magazine they published, The Romantic, didn't have any Fifty Shades stuff in it. It was a genuine literary magazine of dull neo-Victorian poetry and art, with columns titled things like Pippa's Pipsy Page and Parlez-vous Romantique. When St. Bride's moved to Oxford in the 90s, they would hold black tie soirees with students where their old wind-up gramophone played music hall songs, cocktails were paid for in shillings, which stopped being legal tender in 1971, and guests were forbidden from talking about anything that happened past World War I. There was a man in the group at this point, a butler called Mr. Bowes, who an unnamed Oxford student described in the Sunday Telegraph as a, quote, "rather odd person." There's no other record of who he was or why he was odd. Upstairs in the same house, paying customers would get disciplined, but the students attending the soirees had no idea that was happening, and they didn't see anything sexual about St. Bride's. So, we need to go even deeper. Remember how I said St. Bride's house in Burtonport got repossessed? Who repossessed it? Who were they renting their house from? Well, give a listen to this clip. Turn it up. The audio quality isn't great. This clip of a guy screaming is from an art piece called Danger Music 17 by Dick Higgins, performed live at the Australian Institute of Music in 2011. There's an introduction to it too, which does not consist of screaming here.
In Danger Music number 17, Higgins sets out to see just how much expression he can cram into a minimal unit. This was one of Higgins' favorite scores to perform, and once he performed it at a friend's party and was promptly asked to leave.
Back when I did Tours Cabinet on the radio at my college, I used Danger Music 17 as bumper music all the time. It was one of my favorite running gags. Now, Dick Higgins didn't invent the idea of screaming a lot to release your emotions. You could, in fact, make a religion out of that. And that's exactly what one Jenny James did in 1974. She had read the book The Primal Scream, a 1970 pop psychology bestseller, endorsed by John Lennon and Yoko Ono, which asserted, amid a lot of weird Freudian shit, that everyone has repressed childhood trauma and you have to scream it out. Today, Primal Scream Therapy is best remembered for being a pretty good band name, but it was a real fad in the early 70s, and nobody took it quite as seriously as Jenny James. She bought an old manor house in Burtonport, Ireland, and started a commune called Atlantis, some called it a cult, based around the practice of primal screaming. It was the same house that would later become St. Bride's School. Locals didn't take too kindly to these screaming hippies in their midst, and when outsiders visited Burtonport, the locals soon had to explain that all the screaming is in fact not a cause for concern, it's just annoying. Relations soured between the villagers and the screamers, as the Atlantis commune is now almost always known, and eventually in 1980 they moved out to an island off the coast of Burtonport where they were out of the villagers' hair, except on quiet nights when their screams still echoed across the bay. But that was fine. It just gave Burtonport a fun goth atmosphere, I guess. And then it got all the more goth when weird young women who seemed to believe they lived in the Victorian era showed up in the screamers' old house. Burtonport couldn't catch a break. Local news reported that Burtonport had gone from harboring one cult to another, and the villagers assumed that there had to be some connection between the Screamers and St. Bride's. A Burtonport resident interviewed by BBC Ulster in an investigation into St. Bride's said that the so-called headmistress of St. Bride's definitely had a connection to the Screamers. He knew her as Bridget, but she was probably the same person as Miss Partridge and Miss Martindale, and possibly the same person as Priscilla Langridge, the video game designer. There were definitely multiple people who appeared in public as Langridge, and the story of her arriving at St. Bride's with a Commodore 64 under her arm is doubted by most people covering the story. Whether or not St. Bride's originally had ties to the Screamers eventually fell into conflict with St. Bride's and repossessed the house, which they still own. According to several Burtonport residents, there was a days-long standoff between the Screamers and the Ladies of St. Bride's in 1992, which ended with two of the Screamers entering through the window, and St. Bride's being driven out, disappearing off to who knows where, before they resurfaced about a year later in Oxford. We do know this. St. Bride's didn't evolve organically out of the Screamers. The group that became St. Bride's arrived in Ireland from Yorkshire in the north of England around 1980. They called themselves the Silver Sisterhood or the Rhenish Community, the latter being a reference to the Welsh mythological figure and Fleetwood Mac song inspiration, Rhiannon. St. Bride's was coined when they moved to Burtonport. The first serious report on the Silver Sisterhood comes from 1982, where the Irish national broadcaster RTE made a mini-documentary on them. This is before anyone even suspected them of being into kinky stuff, before they started releasing video games, and before they started selling all-inclusive vacations at their fake Victorian boarding school, and the clip paints a very different picture of them. According to this mini-doc, they really were a cult, albeit not a very threatening one. They were a matriarchal society that grew all their own food, made their own musical instruments, and generally lived a simple hippie commune lifestyle of drum circles and worship of the Mother Goddess. The second wave feminist idea of a mother goddess went way beyond just this niche community. It was common among feminists of the time and was based on an actual historical theory that pre-agricultural people had been peaceful and matriarchal, worshipping a single goddess associated with nature, fertility, and femininity, before men overthrew the mother goddess and replaced her with a violent, sex-obsessed patriarchy. The theory has mostly fallen out of favor today, but it makes sense why feminists in that era of feminism would have been a fan of it. The aforementioned Oregon magazine Woman Spirit, which did an elaborate article on St. Bride's and the Silver Sisterhood in 1984, was one of the main promoters of the neo-pagan goddess movement. So now we seem to have four wildly different images of who St. Bride's School were and what they did. You can group them by whatever four-quadrant way of viewing the world you'd like. Earth. They were mother goddess worshippers. Air, they were groundbreaking video game designers. Fire, they lived like people in the Victorian era. And water, they were a kinky S&M fandom thing. I actually don't know how I would link that one to water, it's just the one left over. Maybe you could say, yeah, I'm gonna do this like JREG, it's a political compass. Left libertarian, they were mother goddess worshippers. Right libertarian, they were tech people. Left authoritarian, they were lesbian dominatrixes. And right authoritarian, they were neo-Victorians. But there's an avatar, or a forward party, or whatever, that ties this increasingly tortured metaphor together. There is an explanation for all four of these ideas coexisting in one cult-like group. Before they arrived in Ireland, and before they had a commune in Yorkshire, the film journalist Owen Williams claims, in one of the deepest dives anyone's taken into the world of St. Brides, he claims the Silver Sisterhood began as a, quote, sapphically inclined student group at Lady Margaret Hall, a women's college at Oxford. Or maybe they weren't students, but they just lived in Oxford, nobody's sure. Either way, bit by bit, the leaders of the group began to develop a complex philosophy built around a fantasy world called Aristasia, from the Greek word for best. Aristasia had no men, but two genders, both of them feminine. Chelani, or blondes, who were submissive childbearers, and Melini, or brunettes, who were in charge. The real world was known as Telluria, and was considered to be in a state of decline. The social upheaval of the 60s was nicknamed the Eclipse, which put the world into an apocalyptic state called the Pit. Modern-day Britain was called the Yeek. The early Silver Sisterhood was simultaneously sapphic and neo-Victorian, socially progressive and socially conservative. In other words, they invented the whole 2010s dark academia aesthetic, and made a religion out of it. Weird as that may sound, there's a word for this kind of thing. A paracosm. You probably have personal experience with paracosms. When you were little, being maybe 10 to 12 years old seems to be the peak of this kind of thing, did you and your friends create an entire detailed fictional world? Was it all you talked about for months or years? Did you have specific set roles for yourselves in this other world? Did you write piles and piles of stories set there? Maybe even attempting to create a language? Or multiple languages? You did, right? Or at least you know someone who did. That's a paracosm. And unfortunately, you probably lost interest in it as you became a teenager. Your parents might have saved all your maps and flags and handwritten notes, and now they're gathering dust somewhere in your attic. Maybe you still have your same friends from that era, but you don't talk about that now. That's cringe. You don't want to remember it. But to paraphrase Randall Monroe, when adults complain that you're not working at your full potential, don't take it too hard. They complain way more when you do. Paracosms can be forgotten, or they can turn into best-selling fantasy novels later down the line, but they can also turn into maladaptive daydreaming. If a paracosm arises between multiple people as a response to stress in their real lives, it can take over. It can become their real world. Peter Jackson may have created the best on-screen treatment of a paracosm, and it's not the Lord of the Rings movies, even though Middle-earth did begin as a paracosm created by J.R.R. Tolkien in order to create societies that spoke his constructed languages. But before Jackson directed Lord of the Rings, he directed a movie called Heavenly Creatures, based on a real-life murder that happened in his native New Zealand in the 1950s. In 1954, the working-class college groundskeeper, Honora Parker, was bludgeoned to death with a brick by her own teenage daughter, Pauline, and Pauline's friend, Juliet Holm. Parker and Holm had initially bonded over having numerous health issues and turbulent family lives, and they coped with the stress by creating an elaborate fantasy world called Barovnia. As their real lives took turns for the worse, Barovnia became a religion. Parker and Holm began to believe that they would go there when they died. And when Holm's parents got concerned that the girls were bad influences on each other, and planned to send Holm to live with her relatives in South Africa, Parker decided that she had to go to South Africa too. But there was no way her mom would let her, so her mom had to be taken out of the picture. These were smart, precocious teenage girls, driven to the point of committing murder because their fantasy had overtaken reality. So now it's not too hard to picture how the Silver Sisterhood got started. I find that I emphasize how the 1970s were a really bad time to be alive a lot on this show, to the point that I've come to see it as a bit of a running joke, but it's true, and it was especially true in Britain. There were nationwide strikes that caused shortages of staple foods and regular blackouts. Inflation was twice as high as it ever got in 2022 in America. The Prime Minister himself, James Callaghan, told reporters that if he was a young man, he would emigrate. Now imagine that against this background, you're a young, bright lesbian. You're smart enough to get into Oxford, but you can't reveal your sexual orientation to anybody. It would be a pretty miserable, isolating life. And all of a sudden, at Oxford, you meet this group of strange women who understand you, and who want to tell you about this mythical lesbian utopia they've created, Aristasia. They tell you that society is collapsing in the real world, and it certainly feels that way to you. Looking back from the late 70s, thinking of the chaos at the time, the two world wars and the Great Depression between them, it certainly seems like Britain has been in decline since the Victorian era, but of course you couldn't be openly gay in the Victorian era. But you can in Aristasia. Of course you would allow that world to take over your real life. It's how all cults start. Find a sad, downtrodden victim, and tell them there's a solution to their suffering. Only, I don't think anyone in the Silver Sisterhood was doing it in a con artist, we're gonna start a cult and they're gonna worship me sense. I think they created Aristasia together, as a paracosm. So, even though the Sisterhood worshipped the Victorian era, or at least their romanticized vision of it, they weren't totally against technology. Once they started St. Bride's School to make money off their neo-Victorian homestead and guests started arriving, they had to make sure everything was period accurate, but they also saw, in computers, potential for further escape from the real world. There's a website in the web archive called the Encyclopedia Aristasiana, which includes a glossary of Aristasian terms, one of which is electraspace, defined as the Aristasian portion of the internet. There was an Aristasian embassy in Second Life. St. Bride's wasn't against modern technology, they were just against modern society. They lived according to Victorian morals, except for all the kinky lesbian sex, presumably, but more than anything, they wanted to escape from the real world into Aristasia, however they could. Most of the video games developed by St. Bride's School have strong female main characters, and remember how the Jack the Ripper game ends up in a magical feminine fantasy world. But their obsession with the decline of British society brought the Silver Sisterhood uncomfortable bedfellows. When the Screamers repossessed the Burtonport Manor, they found not only lots of S&M gear lying around, but also neo-Nazi periodicals. Yeah, I bet you weren't expecting that twist, except that I put it in the title, so actually I bet you were wondering, when's he gonna talk about the Nazi part? Apparently, Miss Martindale, who probably was the same person all along, unlike most of the other Silver Sisters, she had been corresponding for 2 years with John Tyndall, the leader of the white supremacist neo-fascist British National Party. In the letters, Tyndall expressed admiration for the way the Sisterhood wanted to isolate itself from the modern multicultural world. He said that he was, quote, spiritually with one foot in the 19th century and the other perhaps in the 17th and 18th. The Silver Sisterhood was also involved in a rather less explosive, but also traditionalist political movement. Miss Martindale was one of the public faces of the cleverly named Don't Give an Inch campaign in the 1990s, which sought to reverse Britain's shift to the metric system. Some former St. Bride's residents have spoken up about the Nazi ties, saying that if Miss Martindale was involved in something like this, they certainly didn't know about it, and they certainly wouldn't have supported it, but others disagree. One person who claims to have known the Sisterhood when they were in Oxford in the 90s, says that everyone in the area knew they had fascist sympathies. It's hard to imagine a bunch of lesbian feminist separatists, which is really what they were, being all chummy with neo-Nazis, but on the other hand, they did have a rose-tinted nostalgia for the peak of the British Empire. Either way, it shows that they sank deeper into their paracosm than they should have. And then what? What became of the Silver Sisterhood? There's still a lot we don't know. The Screamers, who were always a much easier to understand hippie commune cult, sold the house in Burtonport in the 80s and headed off to Colombia, where some of them were killed by that country's rural leftist militias, and the rest are still there today. They also began to talk a lot about, quote, sexual freedom for children, so you know, maybe they weren't great folks either. Whether they ever had ties to the Silver Sisterhood beyond just renting that house to them is unknown. And yes, the Sisterhood was active on the internet once that was launched. Someone had to be there to build an Aristasian embassy in Second Life. There's the aforementioned Encyclopedia Aristasiana that was still up until 2012, and was last edited in 2011 by someone with the username Miss Serena. Who's she? and there's a website that's still up called daughtersofshiningharmony.com that seems to promote all the same ideas the Silver Sisterhood believed in, although I'm not sure this is still being maintained. But someone's paying to keep it up. Who? Miss Martindale eventually resurfaced, seemingly out of weird lesbian cult stuff for good. Under a different name, she moved to America, married the late John Gillerman, director of 1974's The Towering Inferno and the first King Kong remake, becoming Mary Gillerman, a wealthy and respected marriage counselor for celebrities in Los Angeles. She also put on a one-woman play in 2019 titled, I'm not making this up, From Crazy to Sane, or Am I? Her true name, age, and origin before the 1970s are still completely unknown. There were, presumably, at least into the 2010s and maybe still today, people who believed in Aristasia. And ultimately, despite all this, I'm not sure we have a real explanation for why they made video games about branching caves and rabbits that were Chicago mobsters. In the words of Owen Williams, some things about St. Brides and the Silver Sisterhood will remain a riddle, wrapped in a crinoline, inside an enigma.
Loaded question will break.